Hello, hello, hello. This is the Committee on Health and Human Services and Housing. It is January 21st, 2015, and this meeting today is a continuation of our conversation about the recommendations from the Governor's Task Force on Child Protection. I'm hoping that the rest of our committee arrives here because the purpose for extending this was to make certain that their questions regarding what will be in the bill will be answered fully before we present the bill in front of the legislature. So for those of you who are here, you should know that we've simply asked this be an opportunity for the legislators to ask the questions they need to prepare for the hearing, which will be at another time. And what I've asked is that for today, the focus be on those things that are going to be in the bill that's presented to this committee. Not all of the recommendations that may be coming forward or are being under consideration by the task force, but those very specifically already integrated into a bill to be presented in front of the Senate. And those issues, I'm asking the senators who are here asking questions to try to stay focused on those issues today as well. There'll be opportunities in the future to look at other issues that that we need to as we improve the child protection system. So with that, I also asked you to keep the sheet that was prepared by the task force. It sort of looks like this, and it sort of checks off those things that are needing statutory change, practice change, training, et cetera, where there's county fiscal impact or Department of Human Services fiscal impact. In there, Ms. White, I'm grateful to, indicated with the letters DE an indication of what the delete all amendment will have in it, meaning only these things with a DE next to it are in the bill that will be presented to this committee sometimes probably next week. So those are the ones that we'll be going through. And we're going to start with training. But first, I want to invite Commissioner Lucinda Jessen to approach the table again and take an opportunity to make critical messages you want the Senate to hear and offer to answer questions at this time. Welcome, Commissioner.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Members, I'm Lucinda Jessen, Commissioner of the Minnesota Department of Human Services. I'm also privileged to be co-chair of the Governor's Child Protection Task Force. And I just want to thank you, Madam Chair, and members for the amount of time you're spending on this very important topic. As I think I said at the last gathering, this is critical, important work that is done in the child protection system, but often it is really shielded from public scrutiny, often by the nature of the difficult decisions that have to be made. But I think that the scrutiny that both the task force and really especially the legislature is now giving this is so important to having improvements going forward. I thought that perhaps the role I could play, Madam Chair, if it's acceptable to you and the members, would to try and coordinate responses. I've asked different members of our task force that have expertise in the areas where I know members have questions to be here today, so that there's a particular recommendation members have questions about. I can ask those members of the task force that I think might be able to best share their experience and expertise to come forward. Of course, I'm also happy to share, you know, my thoughts as co-chair. We have a departmental staff here who can share the department's perspective as well. But we really are here just to try and answer any questions. And as you said, Madam Chair, to focus on what will be in the bill that reflects what I think are really just the majority of the task force's initial recommendations, understanding that we have a lot of work ahead of us as well.
Absolutely. Thank you, Commissioner. Would you like to introduce, I know you have invited some guests to come and be able to answer questions where their expertise exists. Remember, members of the committee, this task force is an incredible task force. It has representatives from the counties, social service, those who are reporters, those who take the reports, those who do the social service supports to the families. It includes law enforcement, includes the judiciary. I can assure you that this is a very diverse group that has broken down its task into work groups that have and very, very aggressive study of the many competing interests that come to bear between units of government, between families and the state. So you can be assured that many of the things that you might want to ask questions about are not questions that have not been asked and answered by the task force. So with that, do you want to introduce you've invited some other folks to come. I'd like you to let our committee know who they are.
So, Madam Chair, let me make sure I'm not missing anyone, but you all know well Judith Brumfeld, the Director of Scott County Health and Human Services. Next, let me just kind of go down my list. Sheriff Therese Amasi, you want to just raise your hand? The sheriff is from the Maurer County Sheriff's Office. I thought her perspective on the law enforcement questions would be very helpful. Chief Blair Anderson, Chief in St. Cloud Police. Next to Chief Anderson is Michelle Zinder-Fisher, who's a Nicollet County attorney. I know there were some questions about the county attorney's role. I thought it would be wonderful to have Michelle here. Rich, let me turn the other way, but I believe I saw Rich Gehrman. Rich is right there, who's the executive director for the Safe Passage for Children in Minnesota. And close to him is Dr. Mark Hudson, who you heard from at our last hearing, who is a certified child abuse pediatrician with Children's Hospital. Molly Kinney. Molly, you want to raise your hand a little higher? Molly is director of family services for crisis nurseries, and I think there may be questions, particularly around mandated reporters and their role in sharing information with her, and I thought her perspective on that might be particularly helpful. Of course, Madam Chair, you are a member of the task force, and if Senator Rosen joins us, she will be as well. So let me just ask, did anyone walk in late that I missed?
Thank you very much. So then let us begin. The first person that I'm asking to come is Molly Kinney, is going to come forward, who's a family services director, as we've heard, at Greater Minneapolis Crisis Nursery, and a member of the Training and Supervision and Practice Work Group. So what we are asking you to speak to is the recommendations. You can give them a number that we are addressing under the training and supervision category. And I think that they are... our recommendations 29 and 30. For those of you on the committee, they're in this sheet here.
So did you want me to speak to those, or do you want me to respond to questions, or how would you like me to proceed?
Maybe you could just summarize what each of those recommendations is, maybe a little of the reasoning, and then we'll ask for questions,
okay,
and if there are some.
So for the first one, we want to make sure that all of the staff that do the frontline work are trained, and we've been reviewing all of the training guidelines that have been provided to the frontline staff. We've also, in here, we want to make sure that supervisors are also receiving training, so that there is some recommendations for the task force to put forward more intensive training for supervisors. There is required trainings for all frontline staff, less so for the supervisors. So we're looking at that. We're also looking at making some recommendations around kind of what, based on what different constituents have told us, both frontline staff, supervisors, other county attorneys, things like that, we've had come to speak to our group, what they see as kind of some of the challenges around the training and supervision as it stands right now. Access to training can be very challenging for those outstate. The availability sometimes can be challenging. Some of the content, what we know now, it, based on brain development and things like that, trauma, we need to be adding some more components primarily to the supervisors.
So I understand that... under that, what we're drawing from that in terms of legislation then is language that will establish requirements for competency-based initial training and support, not only for the reporters but for their supervisors, so that we're certain that there is some consistency and follow-through and support for frontline workers. And also includes to develop a set of competencies specific to child protection supervisor knowledge.
Exactly.
So that particular requirement will be articulated in the upcoming legislation. Okay, so number 30, the recommendation 30, it's about to monitor county and social service agencies' compliance. Can you speak to that?
That's just another piece that we want to see more oversight around, and I think some of those practices are already being put in place to some degree, at least. And so we're just wanting to make sure that it's written in language that it is monitored and that there are standards in place to be able to make sure that those are being followed through with.
And may I ask, when you're talking about oversight of social service agencies, is it more than efforts to monitor county social service agencies' compliance with just the training and supervision, or is this a broader oversight of counties to comply with all of the statutes?
We are still working on that, but my understanding is, from what the discussions that we've had so far, is there's an expectation that there's somebody is appointed at each site to be able to monitor that, and then they are what gets reported to. So just reviewing that in more detail, we're having somebody come and speak to us about that process. So that piece of it is still we're still working on it.
Senator, or Commissioner, my understanding of this recommendation has DHS's role increased, not only the counties. Is that correct?
Madam Chair, that is correct. There are some things that we have started to do just in the last year to step up our oversight. I think if you go back to the original OLA report, they even talked about that the way the system is designed, that it is weak supervision from the department the way it is designed. I think that under the governor's direction, for an example, we started doing audits of screening decisions to better inform our decisions. We do kind of quality assurance reviews on a regular basis, but I think that we can do more of those. And also we need to provide more technical expertise as part of this oversight to especially smaller counties that don't have the expertise in dealing with what can be very difficult issues. So those are some of the things we started to put in place, but I think that this recommendation very appropriately calls for the department to do more to monitor, and I think that's particularly important just because one of the things I believe in, just jump in here, Molly, if you think I'm wrong about this, but I think is reflected in our report, is there are real inconsistencies across counties. So another reason that we think more oversight is as a task force is appropriate.
I would just like to add that, yes, and I believe that they have started some pretty specific monthly reviews already in reviewing different cases and have a certain set of standards that they're looking at. So moving more to that direction and providing more standards around that process.
In the role of this is the person that is taking and reviewing the report of maltreatment and screening that report, and we're wanting to improve their capacity to do that job well. Mm-hmm. Are there requirements, educational requirements, for a person in that position other than maybe a specific on the job training for this particular role, or is this scope of competencies unique and defined and could be brought into multiple healthcare providers?
Well, I think that, Madam Chair, that we do have a set of competency-based trainings specifically for those frontline.
What's happening here? Is there a cell phone on or something happening here? Okay, try again.
Madam Chair, we do. I think that the task force very appropriately said that there's a gap and that we don't have training specifically for supervisors, and I think that's a very appropriate recommendation. We do have training specifically for those child protection kind of frontline workers. I think we are also looking at what we can do to beef that up, and then you'll look at our recommendation 31 looks at some new and additional training, kind of on some additional areas that and that's still a work in progress as far as what those should be. But we identified kind of some additional areas, including cultural competency, where we think additional training is necessary. But we do have training for those frontline workers, and I know that certainly if the committee wants to know more about that, we have either staff from the department or I think probably Judith Brumfall from the county could describe that in more detail.
Yeah, no, I that really was not what I was trying to get
Sorry.
At, which, and I had the clumsiest question that I think I've ever asked in the history of the universe, so let me try again. I'm trying to get at this idea that Senator Rosen has expressed on occasion, and that is that that it's possible that there are other professionals like our paramedics who could get this training. So the question is there any requirements that we have aside from this training for the person who becomes the child protection worker? And you may not know the answer to that. Other than, do they have to be a,
I know in general,
a registered nurse, or do they have to be a physician,
general,
or do they have to be?
Could I ask Ms. Brumfield to perhaps address that?
Great. Madam Chair, there are not very specific requirements at this time. The merit system has certain requirements for a social worker, but that does not mean a bachelor's degree in social work. It's social work or a related field. So, and then the counties that do not use the merit system have to use some of the same qualifications. For a child protection worker, you're basically looking at someone with a bachelor's degree plus experience in one of the social sciences, and then the specific child welfare training that is provided by the state. And it is listed as training that must happen within the first 6 months.
Okay, great. Thank you. That really is something we're talking about in the future, and I'll let that go for now. So are there any questions?
Can I just make one more statement about that? I think one of the recommendations in our training and supervision subgroup is that those trainings.
We don't know if that's a cell phone or what that is. Sorry.
No problem.
I'm very sorry.
Madam Chair, the training that the child protection workers take is under the umbrella of child welfare training. And one of the recommendations that we, as the work group that's looking at that, is that possibly there's more specific and more additional training for those child protection workers, because child welfare is the big umbrella, and really focusing more attention and more specific related issues to the child protection work to allow those people on the front lines to feel that they're competent and capable of managing some of these really tough decisions. Thank you.
Any questions on training? Thank you very much. I'd like to invite to the table Michelle Zender-Fisher from Nicollet County, who will be addressing the elements in the bill that are related to screening and transparency.
Good afternoon. I'm, as stated, Michelle Zender-Fisher. I'm Nicollet County.
Can you pull your microphone up? It's very difficult to hear. This committee room is terrible about volume. So,
is this better?
Yes. Is it better? Can you hear?
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm Michelle Zender-Fisher. I am the Nicollet County Attorney. Not only serve as county attorney, but I do the work of child protection in Nicollet County, and I have done so since I joined the office in 1995, which I used to say freely, but now I have some reservation about saying how long I've been doing this job. I am pleased to serve on the screening and transparency group, and we have put together some very specific recommendations for consideration to the full task force that were adopted by the task force. And you want me to, I'll just kind of highlight some of those recommendations and why those recommendations were put forth by the task force. The first that seemed to gather steam very early on in the hearings was the need to repeal the legislative language about not being able to consider prior screened out reports. The consequence of not considering a prior screened out report, I think, can be summarized by example. And that is, when I have an opportunity to speak to mandated reporters, I tell them that it's not their job to identify whether abuse or maltreatment has occurred or is occurring. It's to report their suspicion of abuse or neglect to the authorities and allow the system then to respond to that report. And oftentimes we have different mandated reporters who see a child. So perhaps we get a report from a teacher with a piece of information, and we get a report from a daycare provider on the same child providing different information. Maybe the child is in the process of disclosing abuse and chooses to share information with different reporters. allowing us to consider all the reports, even if one by itself doesn't meet it, but considering that information together allows us to address abuse, possible abuse or maltreatment of a child. We can put that information together. It can also be important in situations of neglect, which are far more difficult to quantify and articulate perhaps by a reporter. And we can put information together and see where there are problems or issues. As it stands now, we can't consider those prior screened out reports. And the only purpose that's allowed in the statute is for purposes of offering services. It doesn't allow us to go back and go, for example, to that mandated reporter if we get a subsequent report. What do we do with that prior information? It's important for the safety of the child.
May I just to clarify, what we're talking about now in the process of movement through the child protection system is really the first step where the system receives a report from a mandated reporter or for someone, and how there's no determination of fact made at that point. It's simply going to be screened in for further assessment or screened out as not needing further assessment. Is that a correct analysis?
That's a correct analysis. So the recommendations that the work group that I have look at that very first stage. I look at the process as three stages. The first is determining how are we going to respond to information. Is that information going to get into the system? The middle stage is, are we going to put it in family assessment or family investigation, and how are we going to do that process? And then the final is, what services, if any, are we going to offer to that family? And so that's what the work group that I have is at the very beginning.
At the very beginning. And I just want to be clear so that the committee understands that what we've asked the testifiers to speak simply to that first phase. These recommendations that are going to be in the bill implemented from the task force that we're talking about now relate to that first phase. The mandated reporter makes a report and how that is treated at this point. And Senator Rosen was on this task force as well. Okay, please continue. So the first recommendation is that you can consider
prior screened out reports, and that's recommendation number one of the task force. The presentations, as I said, from the very beginning hearings that the task force heard. Was repeated by just about every presenter that we had, and I know that we heard it in all three work groups as well. So that was our number one recommendation to the governor. The second recommendation of the...
Yes, Senator Nelson.
Oh, thank you, Madam Chair. Before we leave that first recommendation,
sure.
I just have a couple questions.
Very good.
That is a key recommendation, and I think the entire state of Minnesota realizes that this is essential. But I just, until there was the incident of the young boy who none of those reports had been considered, I think many of us were unaware of the this change in law. And I think it happened last year or the year before, I just want to clarify and also get for the record and then ask how do we would make sure we don't something like that doesn't happen again. I understood that it was a department request to bar the looking or considering screened out reports, and that was passed by the legislature recently within the last year or two in that department bill. And so that brings me to two questions, if my understanding of that history is correct. One, why did the department recommend that screened out reports not be allowed? And then more importantly, I think it's worrisome that this type of barring out of screened out reports was just kind of tucked inside an agency bill as if it wasn't important. And so we would not want to see that again. So those are kind of my two questions.
Would you like to try to answer that, Commissioner? But I would ask the committee that, I really didn't, at some other time, if we want to take on the department for a decision they recommended, we can do that. Today, I really want the committee to have a chance to understand what the recommendations of the task force are. It's a task force that's in front of us and trying to help us understand their recommendations. But if you could give a brief answer to that, then I'd like to move on to the rest of the recommendations.
Madam Chair, Senator Nelson. So the legislative auditor did a report on screening decisions across the state and made recommendations to the department. I think that audit came out in 2012. One of the things the legislative auditor found was that there were inconsistencies in screening practices, and some counties looked at screened out reports and some didn't. And he suggested that that be clarified by the department in rule, or I think he actually said in rule, but a rule or statute, so that there was more consistency. We have a committee that on the screening committee that gives us advice on what the screening guidelines should be. We took that to this group that includes people from the department, but a lot of outsiders who are on our screening guidelines committee as well for advice. And their recommendation was, you know, what we put forward in the department bill. Certainly Rich Kerman can probably talk to this as well, we also, working with others, said, yeah, but we ought to keep those screened out reports kind of to track what's happening with them. You know, I think the reason that was given by the committee and that gave us advice about this after the OLA report, there were concerns about whether this contributed to the disparities that we see in our child protection system. There was also concern, this was talked about at the task force too, you know, there were members that said, look, confirmation bias is a problem. You know, but I think as a task force and certainly as commissioner, I do think those are challenges we have to deal with, but I don't think saying you can't look at what happened before is the best way to answer them. So I think that while there were legitimate concerns that drove the department, based upon some advice we got, you know, from a broader group, to do this, I don't think that was the best thing to do. And certainly just talking with county frontline workers who tell me, no, this is really important. You know, but having an understanding that some of the concerns that led us to it are also important, but then we should be dealing with them through appropriate training and through more, and that I think you'll see more of in the ultimate recommendations of the task force about how we need to come to grips with doing a better job on cultural competency, on addressing kind of bias within the system, but not doing that by saying you can't look at what happened in the past. So that's, you know, my best answer, Madam Chair, Senator Nelson.
And then in relationship to the portion about how do we secure our increasing confidence that when changes are made that they are wise, I suppose, is the essence of the question. And I can tell you that we have suggestions if we go through this for how. Once the statute is established, that it can't be changed without a certain processes occurring. But those processes were in place, and we still made the change.
Yeah. May I make one additional comment, Madam Chair, Senator Nelson? I mean, there are important matters in department policy bills. I do think, though, this gets to why I think the work of this task force and these committee legislative process is so important. I don't think the child protection system has gotten the scrutiny that it deserves in the past. You know, and I certainly take responsibility, you know, front and center for that. But I think that by all of us looking a lot closer at the way these decisions are made, and one of the most important things I think the task force is going to do going forward is build in more transparency, as you're suggesting, into a lot of this. And with that, I think that these types of processes should, and I'm hopeful in the future, will get a lot more scrutiny.
You know, I think that it's easy to maybe look at the department, but I think that the legislature shares in the responsibility of heightening its attention to what's happening in the child protection system. And to that end, one other concept that I'm considering is that there be task force of this committee that is very specifically held responsible for reviewing the reports and looking at the implementations of what data we're starting to gather so that we strengthen the oversight process that Senator Nelson is talking about. Yes, Senator Rosen.
Madam Chair, I'd like to be on that subgroup. Thank you.
Yeah, I think everybody said they want to be on it, so everybody cares about this. Okay, I think we need to continue with what is the recommendations from the screening group.
The next group that I was asked to address would be number two in the recommendations of the task force, and that really looks at the introduction to statute 626556, which is the maltreatment report statute, and that recommendation of the task force is to include a statement that child safety is the paramount consideration. The current language suggests that strengthening and preservation of the family is the primary purpose. And while that is important to child safety, sometimes the it's hard to articulate, but sometimes the strengthening of the family may not always be consistent with what is at that time fulfilling the needs, the safety needs of the child. And it also, the recommendation also helps to make sure that 626-556, that the prelude to that mirrors 260C, Chapter 260C, which is the CHIPS statute that says that the child's best interests are the paramount consideration in any child protection action. And so the recommendation is to ensure that both statutes mirror each other. And if you listen to the task force, and everyone's goal is obviously the safety of children, and that's what this, we circle back to in every single discussion we have on the task force is, what recommendation do we need to make to ensure safety of the children that we are that we have an obligation to protect? I don't know if there's any questions.
Related. Are there any questions on this explicit statement that the child safety is first when we're considering many, many important factors that in child protection, the child safety comes first?
The next recommendation of the task force is number 5 in the report, and that is sending all reports of maltreatment to law enforcement regardless of whether a report is screened in or screened out. And this language is actually already in statute. It requires cross-reporting already. However, we discovered through hearings at the task force that that wasn't always being accomplished by every county. And it, I think it fulfills a couple of different purposes. Law enforcement has an obligation to investigate crimes. Social services has an obligation to investigate maltreatment of children. They both have an obligation to do interviews, depending on whether it's a family assessment or investigation. So it allows, the cross-reporting allows both entities to work together in accomplishing fact-gathering. And it also gives another pair of eyes and looks at the multidisciplinary approach to child protection reports, which we heard as a task force several times that the multidisciplinary look at child protection reports gives many eyes to look at and evaluate a report of maltreatment. And my law enforcement friends are here to answer how that might impact law enforcement specifically, but it's already there in statute, and it's the recommendation to ensure that it happens in all cases.
Would you like to testify, Chief Blair Anderson, to this issue about law enforcement at this time? Commissioner, were you going to say something?
If I may, Madam
yes,
Chair, members.
Commissioner Jessen.
I think when Chief Anderson described how, as chief in St. Cloud, he worked with their child protection system, you know, and the close working relationship was one of the things that really moved the task force, and that's why I really appreciate your hearing from Chief Anderson.
May I step back and allow Sheriff to sit here as well?
Yes.
Yeah, Madam Chair.
Yes, Senator Lurie.
Real quick, I mean, just one of the things as I read the chart that says what is needed, it says here that a change to statute is needed. So, I mean, I guess one of the questions I have is, if it's in statute, why do we need to change to statute? What does that look like? I understand that it was inconsistently done today. I get that. But if it's in statute, why is it
needed? Commissioner
Jessen. The checkbox says we need to change statute.
Commissioner.
Madam Chair, Senator Lurie, a very good question. And on some of these boxes, we went back and forth when we were making decisions. We wanted to really heighten the need for consistency in this area and from the task force's perspective, the importance of this. It is certainly something that we could do with the department as well. So we went back and forth about whether it does it have to be in statute. No, we can do that. Do we think that having it in statute might provide kind of more visibility for this requirement? Yes, and that's why we have listed it here.
Okay.
I think the question is if it's already in statute. So your answer is it's in statute, but it's done departmentally, and now if it's directed to be dealt with by the department, but this raises it to another level. Ms. White?
Senator Scheer and Senator Lori, as I read through the Maltreatment of Minors Act, it's kind of buried as this random paragraph in a section of law that even the head note doesn't identify that that's a requirement, and it's done actually about three times in different subjects. So in looking at this, what I did is I moved it to a more appropriate place in statute, added that requirement to the head note, and then deleted it throughout.
Other three.
So it's in one place, and it identifies what they're supposed to do.
That's helpful. Thank you.
Thank you. Senator Madam Rosen.
And Ms. White, is this
shifting?
Ms. White?
Yes.
Is this piece in the guidelines for the counties? It is. It would be, right?
I assume so. I mean, if it's part of the statute,
okay.
I assume it is. But I think one...
Do you have
then
someone
I'll
who can answer that more directly?
I'm getting a nod from Jamie Sorensen, our director of our child permissive treatment, that it is in the guidelines.
Okay.
Yes.
It is contained in the screening guidelines as specifically for cross-reporting.
Thank you. Please continue. Oh, Senator Hayden, did you have a question at this time? I'm sorry.
Well, Madam Chair, thank you. I think I want to hear the law enforcement's testimony, because I think my question will start to get at the like, how does that play out? What if it was screened out, and then you guys took a look at it? What would be the things that make you act versus what the social service folks didn't do? So I'm just trying to understand that, and then I may have another question after I get that explanation.
Please continue. Please introduce yourself and proceed.
Madam Chair, Sheriff Therese Amazai. On some of those screened out reports that we receive from Human Services, it has to do with law enforcement only. It is not something that Human Services would get involved in investigating, because it is strictly criminal and nothing that child needs to be placed or taken out of a home or a family assessment need be done. It would be strictly criminal, and that we would take action upon.
Perhaps you could give an example.
Yes.
So it's clear to us.
Yes. In some of the reports that we receive, strictly criminal, it would be more of the sexual abuse, where the individual has been reported to Human Services that this child has been sexually abused. However, that individual is not in the home. So they don't have to... Human Services does not need to get involved in the investigation. That would be one of the examples.
And is there a boundary under the statute, which already calls for this to happen? Is there a boundary around when, clearly identified, when law enforcement becomes involved? I think that's part of what the concern is law enforcement becoming involved where we really want to retain the involvement through the social service system.
And that's the nice part of having a multidisciplinary team, is that we take that approach many times as a group. So there would be two or three individuals that would take action upon a certain report. And, you know, it's difficult not having a report in front of me that it would be Human Services would deal with this, law enforcement would deal with this, or we would take the team approach and do it together.
I think we need your microphones to come closer. I'm sorry that we're having a hard time hearing you. So if you just speak right down into that microphone.
All right.
And Chief Anderson, did you want to speak to this issue in terms of its impact for law enforcement?
Yes, I would. Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. For me, the answer is always, it depends. And the reason I say that is because one of the things that we have gleaned from our work on the task force is that one of the more consistent things is the inconsistency with respect to application and interpretation of rules and laws that are already there. As my colleague said already, and my city we'll use as an example is unique in that it sits in three counties and two judicial districts. And those three counties have various levels of resources. And so what might work for one may not work as well in another, strictly because of their lack of resources. But one of the things that we have done, particularly with Stearns County, and it's proven to be more efficient for us, and it helps us to keep things from slipping through the cracks, is that multidisciplinary approach. In other words, one of my detectives is there every morning with social services when they review the reports. And because we have various other resources, something may get missed by the social work team, or there may be another piece of information that, let's say, for example, one of my school resource officers wouldn't know, because they work and with that child or see that child every day in school. And because they're able to share that information, we've gotten much more efficient in terms of when we invoke our resources or when we investigate. The other thing that it does is it provides an extra layer of safety and protection for those social workers, and I'll give you another example. We may have information about some safety risks at a particular house that they might not know, and they would send one of their social workers into a potentially dangerous situation, but for the fact that we're able to share that kind of information.
Senator Hayden and Senator Marty to follow.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Chief and Sheriff, for that. I'm still just trying to figure out. So what you guys explained, and I totally get this, is this kind of multidisciplinary, kind of integrated model that puts people at the table, and they all kind of look at the information, share information. You know what you might have been involved with the family in some other matter. Maybe you got a PO at the table that understands that somebody is on probation, et cetera. You could bring a nurse or I get that integrated service model, I think. But that wasn't kind of how I read the recommendation and I still, Sheriff, unfortunately, didn't really get your analogy, and maybe it's a little hard. But it seems to me if someone, a child was being sexually abused, and even if that wasn't someone that was living in the house, I'm not quite sure how that would get screened out because the child was being abused. So that seems like that would be screened in because the child was being abused. Maybe not, because you guys are the experts, but I'm just trying to, if the concern going back to this statement is we act to include, to make sure that we're doing in the best interest of the child, it seems like that child would be investigated in the child protection system, and then if there was an actual crime committed on the child, that you would then be alerted. I'm just trying to figure out, and a little skeptical of the screened out process, and then how. And let me tell you where we're being skeptical, because it's not about law enforcement or me being skeptical of you, but being skeptical of people reporting if they feel like this automatically is going to go to the police, even if there hasn't been it hasn't been screened in that says that there is abuse by the social service folks. So I can get all my social service folks to kind of tell me how that really works in real time. I'm just trying to give you a kind of a 50,000 view of it. And, we support and respect law enforcement. We certainly do at this table, but we know that law enforcement sometimes has a tenuous relationship with community by the very work that you do in keeping the order. So I'm just trying to understand, is this really just really about the multidisciplinary process that we're putting in place here, or is there something else going on? And I still haven't really clearly heard if it was the screened out, why you would then need to investigate.
Please continue.
Okay. Thank you, Madam Chair and Senator. We get those.
I need to say your name. It's Sheriff Therese Amazi for the tape.
Amazi.
We get those reports no matter what. So we're already receiving them on the front end.
Currently under current law.
Yes. So it's business as usual, at least in Mower County. And so we're getting those reports as soon as that child protection intake worker is taking that report. They are sending it on to law enforcement. And, we've got computers now, so we're able to do it via email. But when I started, it was all carbon copy. So it's business as usual, pretty much.
Senator Hayden, Madam Chair, let me see if I can offer a piggyback.
Chief Anderson, please continue. It's okay. We just because we have an audio tape, and we want to know who's speaking.
Chief Anderson, speak.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, Senator Hayden, let me try this example to piggyback on the sheriff's example. Let's say there was a report of abuse and the perpetrator does not live in the home, and maybe that report came to us first. So we're going to start our investigation right away. So I don't think she was saying that, that something like that means it would be screened out. Mm-hmm. But then, of course, we would advise or share whatever information we had with social services. And, you know, perhaps they may not take any particular action with respect to the home, but we would already be doing our investigation. And so, you know, things aren't always reported to social services first. So sometimes they come directly to us, if that makes sense.
Senator Marty.
Madam Chair, this is a helpful discussion. I think we might have avoided it if the recommendation said send all reports of maltreatment to law enforcement. The way it's worded, it says, well, even if we've already screened it out and decided it wasn't worth investigating, we'll turn it over to law enforcement. Mm-hmm. But in other words, the wording of this may have led to the discussion, but it's a healthy discussion. And one of the things that I had question marks written here after it last time, and I wrote, is this recommendation due to inadequate screening? It certainly appears to be. And the reason I say that that's worth discussing, too, is because I think Ms. Kenny was saying earlier, which I think is the reality, I think it's good that both law enforcement and child protection are looking at it, but she said something like more eyes on it is better, and I guess I think that that points to, well, is the screening happening adequately? And again, Chief's testimony, I think you said, you know, in some of the counties, you're dealing with three counties, and some of them, they don't have the resources, which I guess is my concern here. I think I like your recommendation. I see why I think it should be reported to both right away, and both should be doing their thing, and they should be sharing back and forth to make sure it's handled in an appropriate way. But I do have concern that one of the reasons that I hear it in both the Chief's testimony and Ms. Kenny's testimony is that, you know, more eyes on it are better, which I'll agree with. But I'm also concerned, does that mean we're not, in other words, none of the recommendations for obvious reasons aren't, or maybe not for obvious reasons, but these are recommendations on policy and direction and everything else. And one of the concerns I have that I want to make sure we don't overlook is if some of the counties don't have the resources to do appropriate investigation, we could have a huge problem even if we follow all the recommendations you're putting out. And maybe I'd just like a brief, wanted to say that, but I guess I'd like a brief comment from any of you. Is that possibly part of what's behind this? And because I think I'm agreeing with everything I'm hearing from both, from all of you, but is that an issue?
Commissioner.
Madam Chair, Senator Marty, perhaps I could take a shot at answering some of those observations, very thoughtful observations, I might add. First of all, I think when we're talking about recommendation number 5 from the task force, and you're right, we could have been more artful, we're also looking at that in relationship to our recommendation number 3. Now, that's something that doesn't require a statutory change. That's something that we can drive through practice, but it's really the task force thought it is important. We need more eyes on these tough decisions. We need it to be multidisciplinary wherever possible, but knowing that even in some rural counties that's going to be tough, at least a supervisor, and that's why we need those more supervisor training. And where there's ambiguity, that there needs to be a consult with the county attorney's office. So if you kind of – and we're going to be issuing guidance around trying to do that. But I so you kind of – reading them together, hopefully they'll make a little more sense. I think on the resource question you raise, Senator, a very good point. We do have we have a county-state work group that's looking at what resources would be necessary to really fully implement all of these recommendations, and more. And the resource question will be part of the final task force report. I would say, getting to your point, that I think, and we've heard testimony of the task force about it, and it makes logical sense. If you think about things, most of the reports that come in are about neglect. Neglect, obviously, there's a real correlation to poverty. So some of the places where you see the most reports of child protection reports are some of those counties that have the least property tax base to be able to fund this. And we know that half of the funding for our child protection system are county dollars. So I think there is that relationship.
Absolutely. And I'm just going to put my task force hat on this. I'm on the task force that's looking at resources. And you did present last time on the graphs the amount of the reports that are really about neglect. And why social services sometimes helps resolve the issue without having to go through some kind of criminal proceeding. But we were alarmed to discover in the task force the funding sources for child protection, 50% is county-based. So you can, and we saw numbers that showed the differential between counties as to how much they spend on child protection per child in that county. We looked at the changes in the funding from the federal government, which is another pays another 30% or 35% of the funds to child protection, 50% county, a little over 50%. And then a smaller amount from the state, which over the last, since 2002 to 2012, I think was the number, has been also cut in the course of our balancing our budget with cuts at a rate of about $42 million. So resources is clearly a part of the causative factors for why we see differences throughout the counties and why we see different approaches to and maybe capacities to be able to protect children in those counties. And it is part of what we're talking about and will be part of what we bring to the legislature to consider, not only these policy changes and the recommendations that will strengthen the capacity of the county workers to protect children and the law enforcement. But the second discussion is what are the resources needed to really implement the plan? And we're not really focused on that quite today. Ma'am, Senator Marty.
I understand and I'll let that go, but recommendations 3 and 5. I think that's the direction we ought to take. I just want to make sure that if we adopt all of these recommendations and we could still have a problem if some of the counties can't put the time in to make it happen. So I'm glad your subcommittee is looking at that, and I'm not sure what the answer is. I know.
Senator Lurie's here. When it gets around to the time for him to fully fund this, we'll only be talking about the general fund appropriation, which is only a portion of this. So I'm going to encourage that we also look in our fiscal analysis at its impact on counties, and typically we only look at the impact on the state's budget, but we need to also take a look at its impact on counties and the services that they're needing to develop in order to implement the recommendations. And then at that time, as we always do, we'll have to say if we can't make it all the way, what of these things will take priority?
Chief Anderson, Madam Chairman,
yes.
I'd like to add one more point. I don't want to forget this. When done properly and consistently, the multidisciplinary approach does one very critical thing right away, and that is build in oversight. And what I mean by that is if we need to get involved and do a criminal investigation, that case, at least in our case, what we do in St. Cloud, and I can only speak for St. Cloud, that case gets assigned right away. And those social workers know that that case has been assigned to an investigator. They know which investigator it's assigned to. And so the left hand always knows what the right hand is doing. And so they don't languish. And, you know, I think we would be remiss if we didn't understand or think that in the past, not just here but everywhere, sometimes those things languish. They get put in a drawer and forgotten about. And that helps us to maintain proper oversight for each other.
Okay, can we continue with other recommendations on the assessment phase if there are further at this time? The screening phase. Sorry to be confusing here. Yes. So we'll invite our Nicola County Attorney, Michelle Zender Fisher, back to the table to continue.
If I may, just to go back to and Senator Marty left, one of the other benefits of the cross-reporting is the fact that law enforcement may have information relevant to the decision to screen it in that social services may not have. And I think that was touched upon briefly, but I think there's a sharing of information there. Number 7 of the task force recommendation is to look at the issue of making sure we're making the best screening decision that we can make when a report of possible child maltreatment is received. And sometimes the reporter has a good start of information, but maybe not all of the information that might allow a county to make an appropriate screening decision. And one of the issues is sometimes the intake worker knows that if I could just make a phone call to a mandated reporter, such as a teacher, I may be able to get additional information that would allow me to screen that report in. And the statute is essentially silent on that issue, but in 2012, the guidelines were changed that said that counties can't consider the collateral information. And so the recommendation of the task force is to allow limited collateral information gathering during the decision about whether you are going to screen a report in or out. The statute currently allows, once you've made that screening decision, for the investigator or the family assessment worker to contact people to do that process. But before you make the screening decision, there's not a clear path to have that occur. And the amount of collateral information that should be gathered is certainly something that the task force continues to have discussions on, because we don't want an investigation to be done before you even make a screening decision, and we don't want too much gathering of information to happen when there may not be enough there to screen a report in. So it's some limited collateral gathering.
Senator Rosen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Ms. Senator Fisher, can you just give an example for the committee? Because I think this is a really important piece here. And we've talked about on as a committee about knowing if there was a child that had a sibling that had a screened in or some kind of family assessment done on them, the amount, what kind of information is appropriate for this gathering.
Of course, as soon as you ask the question, I draw a complete blank. But perhaps one of those might be a neighbor that calls and makes a report. I'm concerned that mom is never home, and the child appears hungry all the time and doesn't appear to be bathed. That report, some counties may screen that report in for a family assessment. Other counties may be a little bit unsure because the neighbor doesn't have a lot of information. A call to a teacher about, are you seeing, does Johnny appear tired? Does Johnny come to school with an odor about him? You know, what can you tell me? And that would give additional information.
Senator Lurie.
Thank you, Madam Chair. We had some questions about this particular one last time as well, and where I can see examples where it would be incredibly valuable to get some collateral information in order to help assist make a proper screening determination. As you described it, the limited ability to do that seeking of collateral information is kind of key, and you mentioned that it's something that the work group is still continuing to work on, and it's something that will be of great interest to the legislature, I'm quite certain, but I see that it's also going to be in a legislative draft before the work group has that limited scope actually well-defined, is what I'm reading here. It says that this will be in the delete everything. Mm-hmm. And then I also see that it doesn't have an indication that this would be a big judiciary issue. I mean, to me, I think
it is.
This should have a J by it as well, indicating that, you know, judiciary is going to actually be very, very interested in the scope and nature of collateral information that we're allowing to be sought. So just a couple of
I can speak. Let me speak to the part of the delete all. This is only the recommendations of the task force. As we've had the language put together for legislation, language related to the data privacy issues and the judiciary issues related to that are in the bill. They aren't, you know, being discussed here in front of the policy committee. And this will make a stop at judiciary in relationship to data privacy issues relating to shared information.
The next would be number 9, which addresses the release of information to mandated reporters. The statute, does allow for sharing of information to mandated reporters, even if they don't make a report, if they have an ongoing responsibility for the health, safety, and welfare of the child. the feeling that I think was conveyed was that if a mandated reporter makes a report, that there isn't enough feedback given about what's happened to that report and happened to that child, when particularly when that mandated reporter has an ongoing responsibility for the health, safety, and well-being of that child. And so it was a call to have greater information, permit greater information to be shared, and that does implicate data practices again. And we're mindful of what happens in smaller communities with sharing information. I think one of the things that it might accomplish if we really pay attention to it, we heard from mandated reporters who never hear back on their reports, and that's clearly contrary to statute. They're supposed to receive a summary back. But I think it increases the communication also and the trust level that can happen between a mandated reporter and social services. If you're a mandated reporter, I can only imagine the frustration that you might have if you make a report on a child and it feels like nothing's done when, as a mandated reporter, you don't know that services are being provided to the family and things are happening for that family.
Yes, I just want to check. It already is an expectation and obligation that mandated reporters get some feedback back, but that may not be fully being implemented. That's currently allowed under law. Senator Lori?
So the mandated reporter who made the report should have some follow-up, as I think what's in current law. This is actually... This recommendation is a little broader than that. It's also for mandated reporters who have a continuing, ongoing responsibility for the health, education, or welfare of a child. And that's actually a fairly large contingent. It's daycare providers, teachers, who may or may not have been involved in the report. It's fairly significant in scope in terms of sharing of data.
Again.
Yes, I need to say your name again, Michelle Zender Fisher.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Senator Lori, I think, again, this goes to we had to check boxes. The piece about being able to share information with mandated reporters that didn't make the report is already contained in statute. So it's one of those mixed pieces in terms of when we checked a box, making sure that it covered both pieces, and again, to highlight that they're already supposed to be doing it.
So, clarification.
Senator Lori.
Madam Chair. So both the mandated reporter who made the initial report and other mandated reporters with a continuing, ongoing thing are in statute today as in the feedback loop? Is that the case? I'm seeking clarification more than anything else.
It is, good, but we'll go ahead and get it articulated more clearly.
It's in subdivision 10 little j, release of data to mandated reporters. I think that relates to sharing information with other mandated reporters who didn't necessarily make the report. I think the first part of the recommendation about releasing information to the mandated reporter who made the report, there was a desire to give more data back to those reporters than what currently is provided in statute.
Okay.
If anything further, Senator Lori?
No.
Senator Benson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And now I'm even more confused. So both pieces of this recommendation are already in statute, or is just the first, the feedback to the original reporter is in statute, the secondary piece, the reporting to non-reporting mandated reporters, is new request for new language?
Let's review that again. These are really fair questions because, that's why we want to have this hearing. The question is what we're allowing under this recommendation, which is in the bill and which this group will either include or not include, is whether or not data can be released. If we change the data privacy law, we have to do that too. But data can be released, I think we have to, maybe not, it's already in law. But is it already allowed under our current statute to for both the person making the report and then for others who are mandated reporters that have a responsibility for the well-being of the child. Are both of those elements currently allowed in law? Correct?
Yes, and perhaps counsel.
Okay, great. That's a great idea, Ms. White.
Madam Chair
White.
And members, under Subdivision 10J of the Maltreatment of Minors Act, currently the local social service agency may provide relevant data to the mandated reporter. So my understanding is that the recommendation is that's going to be a requirement. They have to provide the relevant data to the mandated reporter. And then, in addition, they may provide it to other mandated reporters with an ongoing responsibility. So right now, they're allowed to provide it to the person who reported and any other mandated reporters who didn't report but might have, you know, responsibility. Now it's changed. They have to report the data to the person who reported, and they may provide it to other mandated reporters.
Thank you.
And Madam
Senator
Chair,
Benson?
Just again, we don't have the specific language in front of us. When it says ongoing responsibility for health, education, welfare, would it teacher who's a coach for one season be included? I just want to know how big this list of people is that the counties have to figure out that they report to. How do you gather that list? How do you make sure it's complete? We just have to think 3-4 steps down the road. Does the coach who's friends with the dad but only sees the kid for 6 weeks but might be a mandated reporter, does he need to know? We have some really tough questions that we're going to have to answer to the public, and so I'd like to get some of that aired today if we could.
Commissioner, Commissioner, if you would choose to answer the question or speak to the issue.
Madam Chair, Senator Benson, maybe I could say a couple of words and perhaps ask the Judith Brumfall to answer some of Senator Benson's questions from that county worker perspective. One, just to clarify, the recommendation is just to strengthen the language about you have to get back to the mandated the reporter who made the report, except there is an exception under that the task force recommends where it's not in the best interest of the child. I think the challenge that we've heard from counties is, well, what's the scope of getting back to them? Does it just mean we received it, we took an action, we made a family assessment response, or more detail? And I think that's where that we've heard from counties that there was a lot of ambiguity around that. The second part to those other mandated reporters in a child's life, that's a recommendation, so it's not a requirement. But with that, with your permission, Madam Chair, I would ask Judith Brumfall to talk about just how this could play out from a county perspective.
Yes, thank you very much. Welcome to the committee. I think that this is a great opportunity that, you know, as we're reviewing things that are already in statute, there are questions being raised as to what protections there are. But the determination right now, the counties can give information to mandated reporters who are not making the report, may do that. So, but the question I understand from Senator Benson is how wide a net do you throw, and are there careful considerations in terms of how wide you seek information, and what do you do to make sure that if you don't do that, if it's not in the best interest of the child, which is what Senator Benson is referring to.
Senator Chairman, Senator Benson, current best practice, and we have talked about some inconsistencies among counties, but let me talk about the best practice that I think most counties try and adhere to. The first section requires us to report back to mandated reporters whether or not we screened in the case and whether or not we were assigning it for services. I believe the task force would like to see that broadened slightly so they get a little more information back about really what happened. The second part of the statute that's currently in statute allows counties to share additional information with mandated reporters who are involved with the child. The way the counties handle that at this point in time is you really look at your case plan. So all of those people who are in some way participating in the case plan, it could be a daycare provider, it could be a medical provider, it could be a therapist, it could be a school teacher. Those people who are included in the protection plan that you have designed for that child. So it would not normally be someone who is a coach part-time unless that person was being asked to be a mentor for that child or work actively with that family. So you really look at, are they a participant in the protective services plan for the child? And then you share the appropriate information for them, not necessarily all the family information.
Thank you. I think we're going to continue with the last two recommendations, and then I want to make sure that Dr. Hudson gets a chance to talk about the family assessment recommendations, which are in here as well. And we, again, are running late on time, so please focus on the other recommendations, and we'll move on to family assessment.
Number 10 of the task force recommendation is there is currently a screening guidelines that was developed by DHS, and we found that there was wide practice in screening guideline application, and it is the recommendation of the task force to ensure that those guidelines act as a floor for services provided to children and that counties don't go below that floor, but certainly counties can add additional services or protections consistent with what is defined in 626-556. And then number 12 really is to really looking at the language that says that the acts were done in anger or without regard to the safety of the child. And that language was considered redundant, I guess might be the best word, in looking at the actions that were then listed, which are included but not limited to such things as burning a child and cutting a child. The perception and reality, in my opinion, is that whether an act is done in anger or without regard to the safety of the child, it's never appropriate to burn or cut a child. And so it was to take out that language. And I believe that those were the final recommendations that I may address.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Let's begin then with Dr. Hudson is going to come forward. He is the medical director of the Midwest Children's Resource Center, Children's Hospitals and Clinics of Minnesota. He's the lead person on the Family Assessment and Adequacy of Resources Work Group. Welcome, and you can begin talking a little bit about what's in the bill of the recommendations on family assessment.
Good afternoon, and thank you. So I think we're going to pick up with recommendation number 17. We are going to cover some ground that's been covered already in some of the early recommendations about the introduction to 626, basically. We are making a recommendation that really we want to be explicit that that child safety is a primary concern in any child protection response. We also, along those lines, are recommending that the statute that or the statute specifying that the family assessment response is the preferred response be eliminated, such that there is not a preferred response if we are to continue with two tracks in our child protection system.
Thank you. Let me just orient. I want to make sure people understand we've now moved out of the screening section. This is the point after which a report has been made. It has been screened in. And once it's screened in, clearly the determination for screening in or out has to be under this new language that says that child's safety is first in all decision making. And then the second part of this is in the family assessment phase that where not right under the current law, there can be two what we're calling tracks. One would be a family assessment, which is not a voluntary process. The assessment is required. But then social services offers a set of support systems, maybe to mitigate some of what they determine are contributing factors to the neglect. And it doesn't go through the court system. There's not the force of law. it is voluntary at that point as to whether or not those services can be implemented. And if they accept them, great. But if they don't, there's no force of law at that point. And so what this is saying is that the current statute says that that approach is the preferred method. And we see, as we studied this, that there's been a significant increase in the use of family assessment, maybe because of this language, and maybe in cases where it ought not be the preferred method. So we're simply asking that that language be deducted from the statute. Is that clear? Any questions about that? Okay, please continue.
In the interest of time, we will skip to number 18, which, and I would say really 18 and 19 are somewhat related. And in, as mentioned by the chair, in the family assessment response right now, many times services are voluntary. I will admit that there seems to be relatively great variation from county to county. But if we look at the philosophy behind the original implementation of family assessment, it was meant to be voluntary services. So currently in our current system, we have many children that are entering this family assessment system that are high risk for ongoing abuse, which really the recommendation is that they have ongoing services at that point. And we are making a recommendation that it be clear that when services are not accepted and the child has ongoing safety issues or risk issues, that a consultation occurs with the county attorney with the goal of deciding if this is an appropriate case for a CHIPS petition. Questions? Okay. We also recognize that this idea of voluntary versus involuntary services, whether you are on a family assessment track or a family investigation track, is somewhat, the lines are not clear when it comes to implementation on the ground. So there may be situations where the county child protection service feels that services are needed, and the county attorney may say that he or she doesn't feel that has risen to the level to file a CHIPS petition. So we do think there continues to be a need for further clarification, and potentially as the 626 and 260 come into more alignment, there may be less of that discrepancy that we seem to be identifying.
Any questions? Senator Eaton.
Thank you. Who's the decider when it comes down to that? I mean,
who makes the decision?
Who makes the decision
of whether or not to consult?
Sure, I will take a stab at that. I'm not a child protection worker. Judith maybe want to take a stab at answering that, or the commissioner as well. But there are a number of tools that are used. There is a structured decision making tool that is used on both tracks, and this is a tool that is meant to give an estimate of both safety, one portion of the tool, as well as risk of ongoing harm or repeat report of child abuse. And it is the combination of the structured decision-making tool, the worker, and in theory the supervisor involved who will make that decision about whether child protection services are needed on an ongoing basis.
Commissioner.
Madam Chair, I would ask if Ms. Brumfeld could comment, address this from a county perspective. The task force was not trying to say that county attorneys were decision makers, but there needed to be a consultation. And I think this was really kind of part of the task force's approach, that there needed to be more consultation, especially in tough cases. You know, like when a county is in assessment and the social worker thinks they need services and the family's not accepting them, to have more consultation both with law enforcement and with the county attorney's office. But would it be acceptable for Ms. Brumfeld to
yes, please.
Come up? And we, of course, have a county attorney here as well.
Yeah. Would you say your name again for the record?
Madam Chair, Judith Brumfield from Scott County. The practice in most counties when we are dealing with a family that is not accepting services and we believe there's still a high degree of vulnerability on the part of the child is to consult with our county attorney about whether or not there is grounds for a CHIPS petition. There's a lot of parenting that goes on that does not rise to the level of being able to do a CHIPS petition. Just to be clear, when we recommend services, whether it comes through a family investigation or a family assessment, it is voluntary on the part of the parents until such time as there's court action, and a lot of these never meet that criteria. But it's clearly something we consult regularly with the county attorneys when there's a close working relationship. Many times there's the level of training so the child protection worker really knows whether or not it's going to meet those criteria. If they're particularly concerned, they're still going to ask the county attorney, is there any way we can do this? So, again, it's a very close working relationship. It is sometimes a more informal consultation, a telephone call, I've got this, as opposed to a meeting. But that's a regular ongoing practice.
Thank you. Commissioner.
Thank you so much, Ms. Brumfield. But, Madam Chair, members, if I could say, there was some testimony, and I think Senator Rosen was on the work group that heard some of this, that while I think what Ms. Brumfield said is the best practice, and a lot of counties or most counties are doing it, we certainly heard about counties that were not doing it, that, you know, families didn't accept services, and the cases were just closed. You know, and we really would like a double check, I think, from the task force perspective to when that's happening, if the child's safety is at all in question.
Okay, any further questions on this? Okay, thank you. Please continue, Dr. Hudson.
Excuse me, yes. I'm sorry. Judith
Ms. Brumfield.
Just to follow up on that slightly, as we talk about the resource issue for county child protection workers, just to mention, there is a resource issue for county attorneys as well. And some of the times when that consultation doesn't happen, it frequently is happening in greater Minnesota, in smaller counties, where the county attorney does not have that level of expertise and or the ability to provide the time that child protection is looking for. So as we look at resources, it is beyond just child protection. This is a much larger system. So we're talking about law enforcement. We're talking about county attorneys as well in terms of resources.
Thank you. I don't want to speak out of turn, but this task force, I serve on the task force with Dr. Hudson. This issue that we're talking about now is partially addressed in here, but we're continuing to have conversations around the whole issue of family assessment and about the voluntary nature of it. And is there something, we're having initial conversations I want you to know about, is there something between the voluntary nature of family assessment and the actions that the court take before you can require something the court has to take an action? Is there something in between there that if the criteria is not meeting fully the statutory language for what's required for a CHIPS petition, is there something further that we can do that increases the muscle behind the encouragement for intervention to keep these kids safe? We're just not there yet to make a recommendation for you on that. This is as far as we've been able to move, but there may be more to come as we just study this further. Senator Hayden.
Good. Thank you, Madam Chair. And I'm not sure who might be best to answer this. There's another group in this process that I haven't heard a lot about, and that's the folks that represents the families who are being accused of abuse or neglect. And so it's kind of a little bit of a random question, but I haven't heard much from them, haven't seen much in this document to just talk about how does that work, because our system of justice means that someone's accused of something, they have a court-appointed attorney or a public defender or their own, if you will, that kind of talks about they did or didn't do it, or they feel like what you're asking them to do is appropriate or not appropriate. Because one of the, you know, issues that I've heard from some members of the legislature that kind of do this work is that sometimes what families are being asked isn't in a line with what they need. And so often there's a cookie cutter approach to what this family assessment may be. And that may not be exactly what the family needs, but that's just kind of what everybody does. So is there anybody that can help me understand how maybe the compliance rate might go up or it might change if the family is buying into that based on what their, you know, their side of this conversation would be?
Commissioner Jessen.
Madam Chair,
I think this is a great question, by the way.
Madam Chair, Senator Hayden. First, let me note that Lorene Broom, who's a parent consultant with Prevent Child Abuse Minnesota, is a very active member of our task force. So we certainly hear from that perspective. We also have heard kind of some of our public testimony from a parent advocacy group. They represent parents at clinic at William Mitchell College of Law that came and provided testimony. So I think we are trying to get that perspective. I would also say that the task force heard some great testimony that really got at some of the things you raised in one of our January meetings, where we heard from several groups talking about, you know, particularly in non-mainstream cultures, you know, that there almost needs to be a translator kind of sometimes between the social worker and the child, traditional child protection system in those cultures and those families. And it gave us some, I think, very thoughtful recommendations around that and around how we get away from kind of some cookie, what you would say, called cookie cutter approaches to, especially when we're looking at people from different cultural backgrounds, to make those more, you know, a better fit for that family. And I think that you will see more recommendations from the task force that address some of that are along those lines as we move forward.
Okay, thank you. So, I think that I want to highlight that in my memory, so I'm going to say it again, that we want to make sure that when we are reviewing a person who's been in the family assessment process that has, has not volunteered to participate in the services that are offered, that in the process of determining whether the court should be involved, that the problem of not participating in the program isn't about that we've been culturally insensitive and have not created a service plan that makes sense for the family, rather than what we might assume is just a simply not cooperating and not caring about their child's protection. And I think that's the central message.
Yes, Madam Chair, thank you, Commissioner. I appreciate that. I think the cultural aspect is, you know, kind of something that we talk about. But, there's often a chemical health assessment on someone that has never displayed that they have a chemical health issue, right, or other things like that. So that could be cultural, but that could just be kind of, well, this is what the person has to go through when they're accused of X, Y, and Z. But what if that isn't, you know, the issue? You know, what if it's a mental health issue? What if there's other? So, I mean, I it's hard to come up with those scenarios, but I know that I've heard, and even from a resource perspective, making sure that we use our resources wisely, that we're targeting it to the issue that we're trying to deal with, as well as the compliance issue in of itself. If a person is having to sit through a chemical health, I'm just using that as an example, and they're like, well, I don't drink, I don't use, even though I did this, I beat my kid or whatever the offense was, but that wasn't really the driver to it. So why am I going through this? Which then gets to this non-compliance issue and all of the other wrestling that you have to do with them. So there is a cultural component, but I think that there also is what I'm calling a cookie cutter approach, not to be offensive, but an approach that sometimes we take. Because that's just kind of what we do. So I just wanted to hear that side of it.
I'm going to ask Senator Rosen. We're past our time. I think we'll go, if you can tolerate it, if your schedule tolerates it, I mean, approximately
2 minutes.
5 minutes. Okay. Senator Rosen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Senator Hayden, that's a very, very good point, and that is being addressed. And again, I'd like to, again, point out who is on this task force. I think we have the commissioner, both commissioners, Carter too, and Commissioner Jessen, and the governor have appointed some very good people to address these issues. I would like to share, Senator Sharon, the testimony from Phyllis Sloan from the northeast side of Minneapolis, and she testified in front of one of our task force meetings. I thought it was amazing recommendations to deal with a lot of exactly what you're talking about. So this is a work in progress. These are the discussions that we should be having, very transparent, very difficult, very honest discussions about the system as it is. But it doesn't work in a lot of ways. Sometimes it does work, but we need to get more consistent and fair. And so I will make sure that I think that was sent to us, that testimony, and I'd like to have it sent to the whole committee if possible, Madam Chair.
Remember that. Is that testimony, could you make that available to us and we will distribute it to our committee members?
I will, Madam Chair.
Thank
and
you.
If I may, one other thing. I understand, Senator Hayden, that you're raising. I think that's a really good point that you are raising. I certainly have heard Dr. Hudson and other members of our family assessment work group say that it's all over the map. or maybe that not be your phrase, what counts as family assessment. And I think that his work group really is looking at that, and we will take your comments to heart.
Please continue, Dr. Hudson. We have like 30 seconds.
All right. Thank you, Madam Chair. I think number 19 is really in some ways a sub point of number 18. And I think, again, that this is probably just an area where we're asking for clarification, much more so than a significant change in direction. Currently, the statute does allow filing of a CHIPS petition on the family assessment track. There seems to be some confusion about that, whether it needs to go back into investigations before a CHIPS petition happens, which is not what the statute seems to say. So I think this is an area where we're just looking for clarification that it is appropriate when there are safety concerns and the child is in the family assessment track to consult regarding a CHIPS petition without having to go back and change tracks.
Yeah. Very good. Any further questions at this time? Seeing none, I thank you again very much for coming. We will look forward to seeing you again, I hope, in this committee, because we will be presenting the recommendations in bill form soon. Thank you very much. We are adjourned. Yes.